Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour taking your phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or if you have a difference of opinion to that of the host on any subject, feel free to give me a call and we'll have a discussion about the topic you raise. Now, I need to tell you the lines are all full right now, so you won't get through if you call at the moment, but you will have another chance. Within a few minutes, some of these lines will open up, and you can reach me at this number. So have it handy. The number is 844-484-5737. Again, that's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Jeffrey, who's calling from Los Angeles. Jeffrey, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. I had a question for you today. I had two questions, actually. The first one, hopefully, maybe be fairly easy for you. But my question is, as far as the, I guess the, there's two sets of manuscripts I believe that are used today. The Textus Receptus and the Alexandrian manuscripts. Do they have is there an interlinear Bible for both sets of manuscripts?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I know there's interlinear English Greek New Testament with using the Textus Receptus, and I believe J.P. Green is the editor who put that out. Now, there's also other interlinear New Testaments, Greek, English, that I think do use the Alexandrian text. I'd be surprised if not, because that's the text that most modern scholars prefer. So I'm sure you'll find it, though I'm not really sure who edits one like that. You're talking about finding interlinear Greek, English, New Testaments using the Textus Receptus on the one hand, and another volume using the Alexandrian text. Is that how you're speaking?
Yes, that's how I'm speaking.
Right. I wasn't sure if you meant one volume that has them both.
I can't afford to kind of buy one, so I look online and they have free ones online. But I noticed that some of them, when they give you the Greek and the English, some of them are using the King James Version, which was based on the Textus Receptus, and some are based on the New American Standard. And I was always kind of confused by that, and I never really took the time to kind of compare the two, you know, to kind of see if they're lining up as far as the Greek is concerned. But it was just a curiosity.
Well, of course, the Textus Receptus is used by the King James and by the New King James. And the New American Standard is going to use the Alexandrian text, as are most of the modern translations. One way you could determine whether a given interlinear Greek, English, New Testament you're looking at online is using the Textus Receptus or not would be to look at the end of Mark. Go to their interlinear and look at the end of the Gospel of Mark. If the Gospel of Mark ends at verse 12 or something like that, well, then that's the Alexandrian text. If it goes on to verse 20, I think, I'm not sure what the numbers are. If you have the long ending of Mark, that's going to be the Textus Receptus. And that'd be one of the easiest ways to tell which text is being followed by a given online interlinear.
Okay, I'll give that a try. Okay, all right. My other question, it was regarding 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 12. And towards the end of that verse, it says, or I'll just read the verse. It says, to them it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us, they were ministering the things which now have been reported to you through those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things which angels desire to look into. And I'm curious about the last part, things which angels desire to look into, because I was listening to a message recently, and the teacher, he referenced a verse, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the verse. I think it was either in 1 Corinthians or Romans that spoke about how Satan didn't know God's plan, or that, you know, Jesus was going to go to the cross, pretty much God's plan for redemption.
Yeah.
But I was always, I'm a little confused because of what Matthew 16:23 says about how
Satan tried to dissuade
Peter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yes. I'm trying to reconcile those. And I kind of had a couple of approaches, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, how that could be reconciled, because it seems like Jesus was rebuking Peter for going to the cross or for saying that he was going to die. You know, does that make sense?
Right. In other words, Peter, or Satan speaking through Peter, tried to persuade Christ not to go to the cross. Similarly,
yes.
Satan in the temptation of Christ offered Christ the kingdoms of this world, apparently without going to the cross. And therefore, some say he was tempting him to avoid the cross. If this is so, then Satan must have had some foreboding about the cross and wanted Jesus not to do it, which raises questions about why he would do so unless he understood that going to the cross was going to be Christ's way of defeating him. And therefore, you'd think that if Christ knew that Jesus would defeat him through the cross, that Satan would, want to dissuade him. And yet, the Bible seems to say that Satan didn't know this, didn't know that Christ was going to defeat him. This is somewhat difficult, of course. We don't know as much as we'd like to know. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul says that the hidden wisdom of God, he says, are things that God decreed for our glory. And in 1 Corinthians 2:8, he says, none of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Now, when it says the rulers of this age, many have assumed this refers to the demonic rulers, the principalities and powers. They did not know what Jesus was going to accomplish through his death. And if they did, they would not have crucified Christ. And that suggests that they would have wanted Jesus not to go to the cross if they had understood that he was going to defeat them that way. And yet, if they didn't know that he was going to defeat them that way, why would Satan try to dissuade Christ from going to the cross? It sounds like he's trying to keep Christ from going to the cross. Why would Satan want to keep that from happening unless he knew that this was going to be his downfall? Now, I have to assume that Satan didn't fully understand that Christ was going to defeat him at the cross, because the Bible says Satan filled Judas's heart to betray Jesus. And when Jesus was arrested to be taken to his crucifixion, Jesus said, "This is your hour and the power of darkness," suggesting that Satan was now getting his way. The crucifixion of Christ was not something that Satan was saying, "Oh no, this is going to destroy me. Let me stop this at all costs." No, actually, Satan was bringing it about through Judas and other pawns of his. Therefore, Satan must have wanted Christ to die, and as Paul said, they wouldn't have crucified Christ if they'd known what would happen. But with that proposition before us, as you mentioned, that doesn't explain why Satan, on other occasions, would try to dissuade Christ from going to the cross. And I have to say, it may not be that he really was trying to do that. I don't know. When Satan offered Jesus the kingdoms of this world without going to the cross, it may be that Satan had no concept of the cross. Satan might not have even known there was going to be a cross at that point in time, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Satan might have just been saying, "Follow me. I'll give you the kings of the world, and you'll be my puppet instead of God's puppet." And, that would be something Satan would like, regardless of what the cross may or may not have been meant to him, even if he had no concept of the cross. Now, when Peter tried to dissuade Jesus from going to the cross, Jesus said to him, "Get behind me, Satan." And we've sometimes thought that means Satan was speaking through Peter. But when Jesus spoke further about that, he said, "You are savoring not the things of God, but the things of man." In other words, Peter was expressing human sentiments, not divine sentiments. It's interesting, Jesus didn't say, "You are expressing the sentiments of the devil," as if the devil was the one speaking through Peter. But if the devil wasn't the one speaking through Peter, why would Jesus call him Satan? Well, the word Satan is a generic term in Hebrew that means adversary. And it may be that Jesus was not meaning it as the proper name, adversary, Satan, but that Peter was simply being adversarial, though he didn't know it, to the plan of God because Peter was following the concerns of man, not of God. It's also possible that he's saying, you may not really be Satan, Peter, but you're doing the same work that Satan would do in resisting me. Not that Satan would know that he should dissuade him from going to the cross necessarily, but so that Satan stood in Christ's way of doing the will of God, and that Peter was in essence an adversary like Satan in that sense. Exactly why Jesus called Peter Satan is not, there's not just one answer to that. Sometimes we just assume the devil is speaking through Peter. Well, that's a possibility, I suppose, but then we do have the problem you're raising. Why would Satan speak through Peter and try to get Jesus not to go to the cross? And at a later time, Satan certainly did take Christ to the cross. It would suggest Satan's not really sure what he's up to, what he's doing, or that Satan changed his mind about something, which isn't likely. I think it's more like that Peter was speaking out of his own sentiments, expressing the thoughts of man, not of God. But in doing so, he was playing a role that would really play into the devil's plans, because the devil wants to prevent the will of God, whether the devil understands what that is or not. And Peter was, in fact, standing in the way, or stumbling Christ. He says, you are a stumbling block to me, from doing what God wanted him to do. I don't know that we'd have to assume that Satan was specifically intending to prevent Christ from being crucified, so much as Peter didn't want Christ to be crucified, but this would be because Peter was out of touch with God's plan, and what he was recommending to Christ would have served the devil's interest more than God's, whether the devil knew that or not. Ultimately, it would have served the devil's interest for Jesus not to go to the cross. I'm, you know, ranting a little bit here, partly because I don't have a clear answer given.
Yeah, kind of, my reasoning was kind of along that line. Like, I think he was just acting in the flesh and kind of rebuking Peter for acting in the flesh.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your answer. That's a great answer. Thank you for your time today, Steve.
Okay, Jeffrey, thanks for your call. I hope that does help. Sandy from San Jose is our next caller. And Sandy, it's good to hear from you again. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Always appreciate it. So this week we're doing Romans 2, and at the bottom of Romans 2, which is, or not the bottom, but 2:14 and 15, I listened to your lectures on this. It says, indeed, what the Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature, required by the law, then it says, they show the requirements of law are written on their hearts. And then I think in listening to your lectures, you then go back to, you know, Ezekiel, I think 11:19, Ezekiel 36:26, I think, and Jeremiah 31:32, where it talks about, I'm going to take your hard heart and make it a heart of, you know, a flesh, I think.
Yeah. And I'm going to write my laws on your heart, right?
And I'm going to write, right. Very good. Very good. So I get all that, and it sounds good. My question is, it sounds like this is talking to the Jews, and in the context of Romans, how do we connect it to the Gentiles, or the Gentile Christians at that time, or the Jewish Christians?
Let us come at this with the understanding that Paul is trying to reconcile personal friction between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians in the same church. And that friction has to do with the fact that Jews are concerned that Gentile Christians are not interested in keeping the Jewish laws, which Jewish Christians still often wanted to do.
Right.
And in particular, the Gentiles were not becoming proselytes. They were not becoming circumcised. So what Paul is saying is, here's what I believe Paul's mentality and basic argument is. Being circumcised and keeping the Jewish law, or being Jewish, or being a proselyte, is not going to improve people, because you Jews often break the law yourselves, so being circumcised doesn't make you a better person. And there are Gentiles, he means Christians who are Gentiles,
right,
who are not circumcised, and they don't follow the Jewish law, but they actually keep the real righteous requirements of the law without being under the law. They're not keeping a kosher diet, they're not keeping the festivals, they're not circumcised, they're not Torah observant, but they nonetheless do from their hearts what God wants them to do, showing that God's law is written in their hearts. Paul would then be saying, the prejudice that Jewish Christians have against Gentile Christians is totally uncalled for, because it's a racial prejudice. And when you can actually look at these different racial Christians, Jew or Gentile, you'll often see that the Gentiles are keeping the law from their heart. They're living a righteous life better than some Jews are. And what is more important? And he goes on to say, if you are a Jew and you're circumcised, but you don't keep the law, won't God count that to be that you're uncircumcised? Even though you are physically circumcised, your breaking of the law will make God treat you like an uncircumcised man. And if a Gentile who's not circumcised is in fact keeping the law, God will count him as circumcised. What he's saying is physical circumcision isn't what God's looking at, but whether a person lives a righteous life. And the Jew is distinguished from the Gentile only in this, that they're physically circumcised,
right,
and keep Jewish rituals. Gentiles
right.
don't. But there are Gentiles who are more godly than some Jews. There are Gentiles who don't commit adultery. But Paul says, you Jews say you should not commit adultery, but do you commit adultery? In other words, there are Christians, that is, Christian Gentiles, who are not under the law, but they have the law written in their heart. That's what all Christians do.
Right.
And therefore, they will be counted as if they are circumcised. And that's why he closes that chapter by saying he is not a Jew who's one outwardly, neither is that circumcision, which is outward of the flesh, but he's a Jew who's one inwardly, and that circumcision is of the heart. And so he's saying these people may not be physically circumcised, as you Jews are, but their hearts are obviously circumcised. They obviously are counted as circumcised to God. They are true Jews, even if they're not Jewish by birth.
And that sounds great. And I agree with what you're saying. I think my confusion is, I mean, I see that what you're saying, okay? I'm trying to connect. It shows what's written on their hearts. Now, a lot of people, as you know, take this to be this sort of God's own, you know, they're not Christian, they're Gentiles that have never been saved, but God has this written on their heart. I'm trying to address that issue where someone would say this written on the heart means it's just the consciousness we get from knowing God, or from not knowing God, but from knowing his creation, like the beginning of Romans says. So I'm trying to connect that to go back to someone and say, yeah, I get that, but this is writing on the heart, which he said in Ezekiel. But then they would say, yeah, but Ezekiel was talking to the Jews. Do you see my question?
Well, Ezekiel was talking to Jews because they were the only ones listening at the time.
Right.
What he was saying is that God's going to make a new covenant, especially Jeremiah, more than Ezekiel. We've got Jeremiah saying that God's going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, where
right.
he'd write the law on their hearts.
Right.
He did not say that the covenant will not also extend to Gentiles who wish to be a part of it, but he was already in a covenant relationship with Israel and Judah.
Right. Right,
and
they
would be the first ones who have the opportunity to enter into the new covenant. That Gentiles could do so also is not denied. It's just not mentioned in Jeremiah. Now, what the New Testament brings out is the promises made to Israel apply to the remnant of Israel. So it's not so much that the whole nation of Israel is going to have the law written in their hearts, but the
right.
faithful remnant. The faithful remnant
right.
will have the law written on their hearts. And
right.
that did happen. Jesus met...
Yep.
with the faithful remnant in the upper room and made the new covenant with them. And
right.
So the Christian Jews, he did make a new covenant with the house of Israel, the house of Judah, through the remnant of them, not the whole nation.
Right.
And then,
right.
of course,
right.
Gentiles were added to it later on in the book of Acts. So, you know, there's no denial in either Ezekiel or Jeremiah that Gentiles will also participate in this, just like there was no denial in the giving of the covenant at Mount Sinai that Israel, that Gentiles would have a part of it. The covenant
at Sinai right.
definitely made provision for Gentiles to be part of this.
Right.
He said, if a stranger,
if
a stranger living among you wants to
right.
keep the Passover, let him be circumcised. Let him, you know, in other words, he can become a proselyte. He can become a Jew. So, although the old covenant was made with Israel as a nation, it not only did not exclude Gentiles, it actually included Gentiles. Any Gentile that wants to be faithful to the covenant can join in. Likewise, when it talks about God making a covenant with Israel and Judah, the new covenant, he's not suggesting that Gentiles would have no opportunity to be part of it. but it was going to be made with
Israel. If he write the heart, if he contains the heart of stone into heart of flesh in a Jew, then he could do it to a Gentile. Then he could do it to anybody of any religion, whatever, whoever wants to submit to the Lordship of Christ, he can change their heart.
Right.
Very good. Hey, this is great. I'm loving Romans. I'm loving listening to your lecture, listening to BSF lecture. It's been very, very edifying. Thanks as always, Steve. I really appreciate it.
All right. I appreciate your call, Sandy. God bless you. Kevin from Burbank, California, you are next. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, brother. Good afternoon. Yeah, we all appreciate you and your program very much. I want to talk to you about strategies for unity, and I wanted to do it based on balancing comment from last week. A caller called in regarding the local churches, the Living Stream Ministry.
Yes.
And I just wanted you and your listeners to be aware that I've been meeting with them for about 20 years, and there are a lot of sincere Christians there. There's a lot of believers there that don't believe that they are the only proper group in the city. Just like any group of Christians, you're not going to agree on all items.
Yeah.
But in terms of like strategies for unity, it seems to me that periodically we need to go and meet with other groups of Christians. And just like what your program does, it allows Christians from all different backgrounds to go and hear the other person's point of view. And also, so I went and I spent time with the Seventh-day Adventists and also the Church of Christ. And I found out that, like Church of Christ, if you look at their history initially, they used to say, we're the one unique group. But when I went to meet with them, they said, well, you know, 80% of us don't believe that anymore. Only 20% of us do. So there, it does change over time. Have you ever gone to the church in Temecula?
The Live Stream Church?
Living Stream Ministry, the church in Temecula. Have you ever attended one of their meetings?
I don't even know where they meet.
Okay. Now, they have what's called a prophesying meeting for like 45 minutes, and you would love it because you don't even have to be a member. And when you become a member of the church, you just that's just a result of you being born again. So you're already a member of the church in Temecula. But you would be able to go there, and you would be able to stand up and prophesy for 1 or 2 minutes and enlighten the Christians that are there. And I think that would help bring the Christians from different, it's a way that we can bring different groups of Christians together.
Do you know where that church
more
meets?
The oneness.
Do you know where that church meets?
No, but I could email you the information. But
do that.
If you could
feel free.
That, yeah, go up and just prophesy, but they would really appreciate it.
I'm not going to guarantee that I'm going to go prophesy because I'm not a prophet, but I don't mind visiting them. I should make clear to you that although I have concerns about the early attitudes of the Living Stream churches, which were called the local churches in the 70s, that there was a local church, and I guess still is, in Santa Cruz, where I used to live, back in the 70s. And they kind of broke away from Witness Lee, but they maintained pretty much the doctrines and the cultural affectations of the Witness Lee group. And they wanted to reach out to other Christians in town. They didn't believe they were the only Christians in town. And so I was involved with the church in Santa Cruz across town from them. And our church and theirs got together frequently for meetings. So I became acquainted with the way these churches meet, and certainly some wonderful people there. I have no doubt that most of the people I met there are true Christians and, not the least bit inferior to other Christians. But there was still, at that time in the early 70s, a general mentality in those churches that they were part of the recovery in the sense that God was recovering genuine Christianity from a ages-long apostasy. That Witness Lee was the beginning of this recovery, and that some of the people I met in the local church in Santa Cruz were, they knew their number. You know, I'm number 375 in the recovery, for example. That is to say, they believe that God was currently recovering his church, and that, some of them were the beginning of that. And some local church people in those days, at least just shortly before that time, were pretty cantankerous toward the other churches and referred to them as Babylon and so forth. So, but you're right. I know there is a change in their attitudes, and that does happen. The Church of Christ that you mentioned also has gone through that change. In the early years, the Church of Christ did believe they were the only saved people, and most Church of Christ people I know now would not argue that that is the case. Hey,
right.
I'm out of time for this half the program, but I appreciate your call again today, Kevin. We'll talk again in the future. Feel free to email me that address if you find it. We are taking a brief break at the bottom of the hour. We're coming back for another half hour, so if you're waiting online, stay there. There is an open line you can occupy. We have some of our stations leave us at the halfway point through the program, and it's for their sake that I give this information. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and we pay for radio time, and we do so from money that the Lord provides, generally through listeners, perhaps like you. Those who are interested in hearing the program remain on the stations they're listening to might consider sending support, because some of the stations are not fully supported and might be in danger of us being having to drop them. The address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. If you didn't get that address and you want to donate, you can go to the website, thenarrowpath.com, and see how to donate there. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll be able to stay with us for the next half hour. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We have another half hour of the broadcast ahead of us. We're taking your calls as we did in the first half hour. I'm not sure if the lines are full. It looked like they were blinking, but there's actually one line that looks like it's still open. If you'd like to call with questions from the Bible or about Christianity, or to disagree with the host, call 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Carol from Oakland, California, which means all the calls we've taken so far today have been from California, which is interesting because we're broadcasting in many states. Carol, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. And that last caller was right. We all do appreciate you so much.
Thank you.
I was listening to a sermon on the radio, and I heard someone say that God cannot be tempted. But I was thinking about it, and Jesus is God, and he was tempted by the devil. So can you clarify that for me?
I think so. James is the one who says that God is not tempted with evil, neither does he tempt any man. And, of course, God is holy and pure and is not even interested in evil. He can't be tempted to do the wrong thing. After all, what he wants to do is essentially the right thing by nature. But Jesus, in addition to being God, was also a man. There's something unique that happened when Jesus came to earth. God, in a sense, it says in Philippians 2, he emptied himself of some of his divine privileges and became a man. And this made him subject to certain weaknesses that he did not previously experience in heaven. As God, Jesus also had the handicaps of a human being. For example, the Bible says that God does not become weary, neither does he slumber or sleep. But we read that Jesus was quite capable of becoming weary and sleeping, and sometimes he slept so deeply because of exhaustion that it was hard to wake him up even in a storm. The Bible indicates that God is everywhere at once. He fills the whole universe. But when Jesus was on earth, he was in one place at a time, in one human body, and had to move around the same way the rest of us do, from place to place in order to be there. There are characteristics of God which Jesus no doubt enjoyed before he became a man, but which he emptied himself of these privileges and took on human weaknesses. For one thing, God cannot die, and Jesus came specifically to die, so he had to take on a human nature, which included mortality. You see, Jesus, though he was God reduced to a human incarnation in human flesh. And that doesn't just mean that, that his human body was just a container that God was poured into, but that he took on the human nature by becoming part of the human family. He came through the line of Adam, through a human mother. He had real human nature as well as his divine nature. Now, there were things about his humanity that were weaknesses that he, as God, would not normally have, but which he voluntarily took on himself in order to be tested in all points as we are. And that included being susceptible to temptation. Now, there are some people who teach a doctrine called the impeccability of Christ, and they argue that because Christ was God, it would have been impossible for him to sin. The temptation was more or less a sham. He could be tempted, but he couldn't sin because God cannot sin. And therefore, even though he's tempted, there's no possibility of him succumbing to temptation. The argument is, of course, since God can't sin, Jesus couldn't sin. And yet, as you pointed out, the Bible says God can't be tempted either. But Jesus was tempted. The Bible says he was tempted in all points as we are. And yet the Bible says God cannot be tempted. So we could as easily argue that God could not be tempted and Jesus could not be tempted as to argue that God could not sin and therefore Jesus could not sin. We can say God cannot become weary, but Jesus did become weary. What we have to argue is that while we say that Jesus is God, that really, in order to be truly biblical, has to be qualified. He is God the way God is when he reduces himself into human form, when he comes to live among us in human nature. And that human nature is, freighted with weakness that God does not generally possess. And therefore, Jesus had to take on those weaknesses and become actually vulnerable in ways that God generally is not, and that he, as God, before his incarnation, was not. But that's the risk he took. That's the weakness he took on. That's what it says in Philippians. He existed first in the knowledge, in the image of God, or in the likeness of God, and the likeness of God. He emptied himself and became a man. He took on the form of a servant. So this emptying of himself actually did subject him to dangers and weaknesses, like dying, which he never would have experienced if he had not become a man, because God, in his essential nature, doesn't have that vulnerability.
Thank you so much. I have a second part, but I know there's other people waiting, so I'll call back another day with that question. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. It's good to talk with you. Our next caller is Simeon from Mesa, Arizona, and I just might make this comment before I take Simeon's call. We do get a lot of calls from Arizona. I'm glad we do. We are on actually two stations in Phoenix. Now, why would the program be on two stations in Phoenix, especially since we pay a lot of money to be on each? Why should we be on two stations in Phoenix and pay for both of them when, in fact, anyone in Phoenix could listen to us on one of those stations? The reason is we're experimenting. We're experimenting to see which station in Phoenix, is producing the most listeners. And we are not planning to be on two stations indefinitely. We're planning to eventually be on only one station. And it would do us a great deal of good and save us a lot of money in the long run if our listeners in the Phoenix area or who listen from the Phoenix stations would just send us a postcard. I'm not asking you to send us money, although we could use that too, obviously. The stations are expensive, and if you want to send us money, that's fine. If you don't want to send money, could you at least consider sending a postcard and just say, we listen to your program in Phoenix on such and such a station. Give the station either the number on the dial or the station call letters, and we will collect these postcards and make a decision of which station in Phoenix we can afford to stay on, because we cannot afford to stay on two stations simultaneously and indefinitely. This is an experimental period where we're building an audience in Phoenix in two stations, but we will drop one of them eventually. And if you are listening on one of the stations, it would do us a real favor if you'd send a postcard or an email. An email is cheaper still, and just say, I'm listening, and I do listen to your program on such and such a station in Phoenix, because there are two possibilities. And I think there's people listening on both, but we'd like to know which one is really drawing the larger number of listeners. Having said that, let's talk to Simeon, who's listening on one of those stations in Arizona. Welcome.
Hi, and I will consider doing exactly what you suggested. First of all, I want to commend you for your wonderful, wonderful spirit you have in answering people. I think it's just, you're perfectly balanced in that way.
Well,
and I appreciate that. You're not argumentative. You're just there. And if people disagree with you, you're very, very, diplomatic in the way you answer. The other thing I wanted to comment about is Mormonism came up. In Arizona, this is like a head after Utah. It's pretty heavy with Mormons here. Uh-huh. And I had a friend of mine several years ago challenge me to go to the Mormon ward and share my testimony. And I'm glad that you brought that up about going round and round with discussions and getting nowhere and thinking that it's a good idea to share your testimony. And I've done that at several Mormon wards. And I'm going to tell you something. Every Mormon ward worldwide, the first Sunday of the month, they're all fasting and it's testimony day. So any believer can go there on a Sunday, and they can share their testimony.
Now,
I told my friend, I said, I don't believe Joseph Smith is a prophet. And he says, Carl, why don't you come and share your testimony out of the Bible? And that's exactly what I did. And I'll tell you, it opened some really exciting doors by doing that.
That sounds like a good idea. I didn't know that they had that kind of an open forum available.
They do. Yep.
That's great. Well, thank you for that information. Is that your whole purpose of calling?
Well, that and, I know you're like a preterist and there's different degrees of it, but I'm kind of the consideration that both are right, that about Revelation, and then what you're talking about, you're right too. But I kind of think that you're looking at more of a shadow fulfillment, and then there's a literal fulfillment, how that there can be kind of like a seemingly dual fulfillment of scripture. So I don't argue with people about one or the other because I actually think both are right. I don't know.
You know, I think it's a great idea.
Before, but yeah,
I think it's a great idea not to argue about Revelation.
Although
there's nothing wrong if someone chooses to argue their point, as long as they can do so in the spirit of saying, it doesn't matter to me if you change your mind to agree with me or not, but I would like to give you my reasons so that you'll know that I am not just blowing smoke. You know, I have reasons for my belief. But I'd be glad to exchange arguments, so to speak, in the sense of evidences for different views. I always love to do that with people. But it's important not to turn it into an argument in the sense that we think of it as contentious, because Revelation's meaning, although it is important in some measure, it's one of the less important things that Christians argue about, and many things are far more important than agreeing about Revelation.
I agree, and you're the epitome of diplomacy in that area. You're a master at it, and I really commend your attitude. I really do.
Well,
I wish
you.
I was there in California to partake of your meeting sometime.
I wish you were too, but it's good to have
listeners
there. I enjoy
listening
on
the radio, and I guess I'll have to send something in to tell you how much I appreciate you. All right?
Thank you. Well, I'm not asking people to write in to thank you. I'm not asking people to write in and flatter us, but just to let us know that the station you're listening to in the Phoenix area is, tell us which one. And because over a period of time, we're going to have to make a decision as to which one to keep and which one not to, which is sad, because we actually like our relationship with the radio stations that we have, including both of them in Phoenix. But obviously, we can afford to be on one, not on two, indefinitely. Sandy from Lake Stevens, Washington is our next caller. Sandy, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for my call. I was calling to see, and I am driving, and I apologize if there's static in the line, but I'll be pulled over in a second to talk and listen. How would you approach a conversation with someone who has studied Egyptian history for a long time, has a degree. And when we talk about Christian issues, they typically bring up the fact there's artifacts in several museums in Europe that talk about the 49 confessions of the Egyptians, as well as talks about the mythology of Greek mythology of Horus. And these things I haven't studied, so it kind of caught me off guard. But there's
you mean,
question was,
go ahead, wait, do you mean that your Egyptian scholar friend is comparing the claims of Christianity with the claims of Horus religion?
Right. That's
okay.
I guess his point was, how could Christianity, how could that exist? How could the things like the 49 confessions, for instance, all the top of the Ten Commandments are part of the 49 confessions, although they're written a little bit differently. His approach was, how could you have these 49 confessions before Moses was born and then say that they're part of the Ten Commandments? Does that make sense? I'm probably...
I understand the question. I understand the question, I think. And let me just try to address it if I can. It is true that there are many parallels between biblical faith, that which is revealed to Moses and the prophets on the one hand, that which is revealed through Christ and the apostles on the other hand. Between those biblical faiths and pagan faiths, there are many points of comparison. Frankly, the best ethical teachings of all religions are very similar. It'd be hard to imagine any religion worth its salt that did not forbid murder and adultery and stealing and bearing false witness, did not require people to honor their parents, and did not require them to honor their God. Obviously, that's what the Ten Commandments contain. Now, there are some specific commandments, for example, the fourth commandment about keeping the Sabbath, which I was not aware if Egyptian religion included that, but it wouldn't bother me if it did. To have a holy day set aside would be fairly normative, I would think, for most religions. In other words, people will often find out, wow, you know, I was raised aware of the Ten Commandments, and now I find similar things taught in this pagan religion or that pagan religion. Sometimes people appeal to the ancient laws of Hammurabi, a Mesopotamian king of ancient Babylonia, and they say, look, there's a lot of parallels there between that and the law of Moses. And it predates the law of Moses. So, you know, how could we say that God revealed the law to Moses when these other religions had some of the same features? Well, my understanding would be that all thinking people who are ethical would have a lot of things in common with all other thinking ethical people. Like I said, it'd be very unusual to find ethically enlightened people of any religion who did not disagree with the practice of murder or adultery or stealing. And there's a basic decency and a basic morality which is widely shared outside of Christianity and outside of Judaism. And the fact that God put those Ten Commandments together as he did when he instituted the nation of Israel doesn't mean that he's saying, hey, I've got some original ideas here that you've never heard before and you'll never hear anywhere else. So let me tell you, don't murder, don't steal, don't commit adultery. God was not pretending that these were new ideas. Actually, many of the things in the law were presupposed by Abraham or even, frankly, by Cain and Abel. And therefore, a long time earlier than Moses' time, a lot of those laws or the principles embodying them were well known in the family of Abraham and outside the family of Abraham. So it never has bothered me when people have found similar ethical codes in religions outside the Bible. It doesn't mean that God, when he made his covenant with Israel, did not choose the ethics that he wanted to include. It doesn't mean God was copying other religions. It means that all religions, in some respect, have some awareness of a morality that is universal and which inheres in God himself, that God has apparently put a knowledge of moral things in people, in their conscience, and that he would codify some of those things in the Ten Commandments does not suggest at all that he's saying, now you are the only people who are ever going to have these commandments. The truth is, basic decency, human decency is something, even loving your neighbor as you love yourself, which is found in Leviticus and in Jesus' teaching, that's also found in most major religions. Most major religions have a line from one of their founders or leaders that says something like, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. So, again, anyone who thinks that Christianity is primarily an ethical code that no other religions had is missing the whole point. The Ten Commandments and the rest of the Old Covenant, and for that matter, the New Covenant that Jesus made, have a different set of concerns than just ethical behavior. That is that people will relate with God in terms of being his children and servants and do things for his glory and do things to please him and have a relationship with him, which, of course, would include living a moral life that many other cultures would recognize as legitimate, too. Now, I don't know the 49 propositions or whatever it is from the Egyptian religion that you're talking about, but I do know, as I said, that the Babylonian religion, which predates Moses, the laws of Hammurabi, had lots of points of correspondence with the law of Moses. But again, that's not a problem, unless one is imagining that Christians think that Moses was the first person to know that it's wrong to murder. No, he was not at all the first person to know that. That was known by Noah centuries before Moses, and other similar things. Even the idea that that a man ought to marry his brother's widow if his brother died childless, the so-called law of Levirate marriage that you find in Leviticus, that was known before there was any law at all by Judah back in Genesis chapter 38. So someone can point to laws in other religions that parallel laws in the Bible. I would hope so. C.S. Lewis mentioned that if someone was asking him to believe that one religion in the world was completely right and that 1,000 other religions in the world were completely wrong, he'd have a hard time believing it. Because a religion that's completely right must have some things about it that are obviously true, which people outside that religion would also recognize. And that is the case. Certain morality is obviously true and is affirmed by all ancient religions and all modern religions, including biblical religions. So that's not a problem. Now, if he's talking about comparison of the myths about Horus with the stories of Jesus, this has greatly been exaggerated. Of course, the YouTube video Zeitgeist makes a big deal about this, that Horus and Isis and Mithras and these other pagan deities allegedly in their mythology have histories very similar to what we read of Christ in the Gospels. This simply isn't true. The video claims that all these gods were born of a virgin. None of them were. Horus was not born of a virgin. His mother had, Osiris, his father, had been cut into pieces, and his mother reassembled the body and had sex with the body, and Horus came from that. That's not a virgin birth. Zeitgeist claims that all these gods had 12 disciples, worked miracles, walked on water, were crucified, raised 3 days later, were called the Son of God, and all these things that we know are true of Christ. This video claims that all these ancient gods in their mythology did the same things. Well, all you have to do is read the actual authorized, you know, records of those mythologies from those who study them. No, none of those things are claimed about those gods. Horus didn't die on a cross. Horus did not rise 3 days later. Horus did not walk on water. Horus was, these things, they're claimed as parallels between Horus and Jesus. They simply don't exist. And if they did, again, that's not seriously problematic. Horus is never represented in the mythology as a historical character in a real historical setting. That's the nature of pagan myths. They could happen at any time because they're not really related with any historical setting. The stories of Jesus are cast in actual history settings. The authors of the gospel tell us who is ruling in Rome, who's ruling in Jerusalem, who is ruling in Israel, and these are actual historical characters. And Jesus and the apostles actually interact in the stories with people that are known from history to have existed. Even Jesus is known from history to have existed. The Roman historians, the Jewish historians, they make reference to him. In this sense, the stories of Jesus aren't at all in league with the stories of Horus or Mithras or Dionysius, because those characters never really lived And I'm not sure anyone ever believed they did. The mythology has more symbolic value for the religions, whereas Jesus' life is a historical life that really happened, and the stories are written by people who watched that historical life and recorded it. If other religions had other points of parallel in some respects, that doesn't bother me. But most of the parallels that are claimed are not true. Horus was not born of a virgin, not even in the mythology. He wasn't crucified. He didn't rise from the dead. These things that are true of Jesus and are claimed of Horus by Zeitgeist and other people who don't know what they're talking about, they're not really claimed about Horus in the true mythology that's out there. So I think your friend probably is making mountains out of molehills. I don't think there really is the problem that he thinks there is.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate it. This has been educational for me. It certainly opened my eyes. I haven't studied Egyptian history that extensively, and I don't recall watching, I haven't seen that YouTube video that you're talking about. But I appreciate your response. Is there, and I hate to ask you this online and not have looked myself first, but is there information on your website that discusses this, these parallels and things like that?
You know, and I don't know about my website, but there is on YouTube a two-part video that I taught refuting Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist is the video on YouTube that thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people have watched that tells these lies. And I made some videos that are on YouTube refuting Zeitgeist. Now, what you would do is go to YouTube and type in my name, Steve Gregg, and also the word Zeitgeist, Z-E-I-T-G-E-I-S-T, Zeitgeist, and with my name, and you'll find those videos will come up.
Okay. All right. Excellent. I did have a part two. I will go do the research and call you back another time to discuss it. Thank you so much. I appreciate your show. I hope you never leave any stations in Washington.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that very much. Hey, I need to move along. I'm going to be off the air in about 3 minutes, and I don't know if Jeremiah from Dallas, Texas can do justice to his question to that, but let's try it. Jeremiah, welcome. Hello, Jeremiah?
Hey, how you doing there? I don't know if we got enough time here, but I'll try real quick.
We may not, but go ahead and try.
Okay, this is a big question. I'm going to assume you believe in a literal hell.
I do.
Okay. I'm troubled about something. The bottom line is this right here. God evidently uses, like, the Chaldeans and the devil and different tools throughout the Old Testament, you know, to do things for him. He did use the Chaldeans in the Old Testament. So, and he has used the devil, too.
Yeah.
The bottom line is this right here. These angels that came down and had sex with women, the sons of God came down and saw that the women were fair and had sex with women. I was taught that those were angels. And then we have angels that left their first estate, and I guess this is where giants came from.
Okay, so get to the question so we have time to discuss it. Go ahead.
Okay. I came across all of these
people. I'm sorry, we don't have time to discuss. I wish we did. It seems like that question could have been stated more briefly, but why don't you call back tomorrow, and we'll have plenty of time to discuss your concerns, okay? Because I'm off the air here in less than a minute now, and I'm sorry we didn't give you more time at the end. That's just how some of these conversations go. But if you call tomorrow, I'll be glad to talk to you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported, as I said earlier. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to The Narrow Path. .com. That is the website, and you can go there and you can donate from there, or you can write through the mail to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's 92593. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless you.